Hello and welcome to another episode of the Uncommon Energy Podcast. On this week's episode, we'll be talking about the Oceania International Championships, which are upcoming, and the registration process that just went live this past weekend. Some woes, some issues there. We'll talk about that. We'll, of course, talk about the results from the Liverpool Regionals, which just took place this past weekend. We'll be breaking down the decks that made top eight, the lists, what we think about them, and maybe a deck that we were potentially a little wrong about on last week's episode as well. Then we'll, of course, have Guess That Flavor Text, everyone's favorite segment of the podcast, and then we will be speaking about Crown Zenith, our first impressions, some of the cards we've been messing it with, what we like, what we don't like, and just kind of what our general thoughts are so far on the set. My name, of course, is Chip Ritchie, and I am joined here, as always, by my friend and co-host, Azul GG. What's up, Azul? How we doing? How's your week been, buddy?
Doing pretty good. My week was okay. I'm still kind of sick, getting over the sickness. I actually, like, was kind of, like, got worse over the weekend. I feel like I've never really experienced that. Like, I've heard people saying that, like, they felt sicker after they started to get better. So that's like the first time I really experienced that. It wasn't like terrible. It's just kind of like a, feels like a general cold. So not like COVID or anything. I'm not dying out here, but yeah, still sick. Hopefully that ends this week and start feeling a little bit better. I've watched most of Liverpool. So far I did a VOD review over on my stream over the weekend. Kind of like I would start my stream up around like 2 or 3 p.m. my time, and they usually stopped playing around like 11 a.m. So I kind of re-VOD review it. I didn't watch it live or anything because I would have been like staying up. I would have been starting my stream at like 1 a.m. So I didn't watch it live, but I've been kind of watching the VOD the day after or the hours after the stream ended. And nothing too ridiculous happening over there. There's a couple things that we're going to talk about, of course, but nothing too, I think, ridiculous. The meta was pretty much what we have seen the last couple of regionals, but it was fun to VOD review, and I plan to do like those kind of VOD review stuff at my future or with future events, like at pretty much after every major event. I think I'm going to be VOD reviewing all of them because I enjoy it, different kind of content to put out there, and there's a decent amount of people who like it as well, so I've definitely gotten fond of doing the VOD review, so I look forward to more of them. But yeah, that was my week. How was yours, Chip?
Week was really good, actually. So my brother, who I've talked about on the podcast before, he's someone who started playing Pokemon kind of recently, and he also is the person who named the Uncommon Energy Podcast. Shout-outs to Brother Denton. he actually had his daughter this weekend. His daughter was born my niece, the first time I've ever been an uncle. She was born this weekend, and that was really cool because, you know, his wife already had his wife's sister has a kid. So he was already an uncle whenever we had a kid a few months ago. You know, and whenever, you know, our son was born, you know, my parents became grandparents already. So whenever my brother's daughter was born, my parents were already grandparents. But we, for the first time, Brooke and I got to be aunt and uncle, which is pretty cool. And, yeah, I got to meet her, hang out. We spent the day over there on like, Sunday, I think, and hung out, watched football, the playoff games, and let Samuel and his daughter Margaret get to hang out and play together a little bit. So, yeah, it was not really play together because like she's a brand new baby, so she just kind of sat there with her eyes closed, and Samuel kind of looked at her and was like, "What is this little creature?" But it was cool. It's cool, and I'm pumped for them to like get to grow up together and be friends and stuff. So, yeah, it's cool. But, you know, with that going on, hanging out with a new baby and stuff, didn't actually play too much with Crown Zenith. I played a few games today when I could, experimented with a few things. I know Azul's probably played a little bit more than me, but, you know, have read all the cards in the set. So we'll talk a little bit more about that at the as we're closing the show out today. But we're going to kick it off by talking about the Oceania International Championships registration, which did go live over this past weekend, and hopefully you're not listening to this and thinking, oh man, that sounds cool, I would love to go to that, because it's already sold out. It was a capped tournament, and they sold out all spots, I think, within an hour or two. It wasn't, like, immediate, which is good, but it was pretty quick, so if you weren't online on Twitter in the hour or two that registration went up, you probably missed out on it, which is always unfortunate, but at least we're not experiencing the days of tournaments selling out instantly like we were last year.
Yeah, yeah. At least it wasn't instant. And I guess for myself personally, I wasn't too stressed about it. I did get a travel award for this event, and something they've started doing as of NAIC, I want to say, is that anyone with a stipend or a travel award does get a registration slot saved for them for, I think it's like 48 hours or something. So that's really cool to see them do finally. And I actually wouldn't hate it if they extended that to like top 32 in each region or something.
Or at least people some of who the get more... the top 16 stipend, right? Because
Do that though.
Okay, do they? Okay, yeah, I thought it was just for the travel award people. Okay.
That's what I thought as well. And actually, this one might be the first time they're doing it for players with stipends, not just travel award. So anyone who doesn't know, if you get top four in a between each ICs, there's a period where the top players who accrue the most points in that period of time gets travel awards or stipends to the next international event. So between what was the first time? Between LAIC and OCIC, the top 16 players in North America, the top 16 players in points in North America will get a stipend towards EUIC, right, and so on and so forth, just like continuously IC after IC. So I think it might have just been travel award players for up till this point, but now I know for sure it's also players with stipends also get a spot reserved them, which makes sense. If you're going to be giving someone money to come to your event, they probably should have a registration slot reserved for them for a reasonable period of time. I think 48 hours is reasonable to get for players to get their registration in. But I think it should be extended down a bit to like the top 32, the other players that are a little bit more competitive than others that might want to make that trip over to one of the ICs. I think that it should probably extend a little bit further. It'd be cool to see that be extended in the future. It'd also be cool to see stipends extended down to top 32 at some point in the future, as well as the game continues to get bigger and bigger. But that's a different discussion. So hopefully as the game grows, both of those things kind of extend to more players.
Yeah, I feel like this is something that doesn't get talked about a lot, the stipends and the travel awards. So the top four players in each region get a travel award. So if you're traveling outside of your home region, so for Azul, if he's traveling to either Europe, Latin America, or Oceania, he'll get a $3,500 travel award for being in the top four. And if you're in the top 16, you get a $1,000 stipend. And I think for the travel award as well, you can like choose to have them book your travel for you. Like they'll book your hotel and your airport reservation and all that stuff. But most people,
I don't think they do that anymore.
Oh, do they not? Okay. Yeah, I know that was a thing for a while, but everyone pretty much just chose to take the
lump sum of money.
The lump sum anyway, right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And you do have to show up to the event and participate in the event to fully receive the travel award and the stipend. I think they the first time I ever got a travel award was when I won regionals back in 2010, and then that's when they booked everything for you. You didn't have a choice to just get money and book it yourself, and then at some point they switched it to being you could choose to get the travel award or have them book it for you, and it always made more sense to just do it yourself. Make sure you get the flight you wanted, stay where you want, and so on. So and now I think they just give you, I don't even think there's an option to get to have them book the stuff for you, which makes sense. Them just giving you the money and having you do it yourself just makes the most sense for both sides, to be honest.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like we talk about like the prize money a decent amount, but that's like honestly for the people who are the grinders, people who are going to all the regionals. I mean, getting a travel award is a big part of why it's worth grinding all these tournaments. Getting, if you get each travel award, four travel awards, three of them are $3,500. And for the one that's in your region, I think is it $2,000? Is that right? Which is still, a good amount of money, obviously. So that's a big part of why so many of the grinders do the grinding, right?
Trying to stream.
And they kind of snowball as well, where it's like if you get one travel award, you just have to get into the top four or top 16 if you're okay with getting a stipend. And, the $1,000 stipend is probably enough to get to Europe if you get a good enough flight, maybe enough to get to LA. Definitely not enough for Oceania. I think it's always pretty expensive to get to Australia if you're, someone who's playing from the US at least. I'm sure it's probably pretty expensive from LA and EU anyway. But people usually will like snowball that, because if you're one of the top four players who gets a travel award to LAIC, for example, there's probably not that many Americans paying out of pocket to go to LAIC. So you're going to if you do decently at the tournament, get some points, you're going to get a lot of points at international championships. You can then snowball that, like I said, into future IC Travel Awards. Just get them back to back to back to back, season after season as well. And we've seen plenty of players do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Azul, one of them abusing the system out here.
So yeah, registration sold out pretty quick. Like I said, I was happy that I didn't have to stress too much about it because I did have a slot saved. And it'd be cool to see them expand in the future. But right now, I think TCG is sitting at 480 players. So that's for all three divisions, Masters, Seniors, and Juniors. The VGC, I think, is sitting around over 200, but I'm not sure how many. And they've hit their cap as well.
Yeah.
But overall, when you compare that to like previous numbers, it is higher. But I think there was definitely a lot of room for... I mean, I think there was a lot of more players that would have showed up if there was more room. And it's kind of unfortunate that it's capped at 480 when back in 2020 was what, 405 was the number. So definitely probably could have gotten up to like 600, maybe 700 players, I feel like, in this one. Yeah, because it capped within like the first hour, maybe 2 hours. I don't remember. I know it capped pretty fast.
But
it's kind of unfortunate with the low cap.
Also, I do have to say, I think that when they released registration also has an impact on like registrants, because the registration went up less than a month before the tournament. So like a lot of people who probably would have wanted to go to this tournament maybe didn't book travel because they weren't going to be guaranteed a registration spot. Travel gets too expensive a month out. So then now all of a sudden you don't even register. So you don't even go. I'm sure there's someone out there who's sitting in that boat, but yeah, seeing that like around 480, 450. I don't know exactly what the cap number is. Maybe it was like 450 plus the stipend earners, right? Get thrown in there, something like that. It seems very low, right? Because we're used to seeing these American, European, and even Latin American regionals having over, you know, well over that number in every single tournament. But when you think about the Oceania region, most of their regionals are right around that 180 to 200 player mark, something like that. So, I mean, it makes sense that it would be smaller. And I don't think, you know, anyone would have, even if it was uncapped, you know, we wouldn't see 1,000 people playing in this tournament, most likely.
Yeah, probably not.
Maybe if it was more months out and if it was like advertised better, but neither of those things were true, obviously. You know, the Pokemon tournaments is pretty much like, you know, the only people who go to Pokemon tournaments are people who are like in the Pokemon community, like people who know about Pokemon tournaments, right? They're not like putting this on the main Pokemon Twitter pages. They're not putting it on the front page of the website, go register for these Pokemon tournaments. And so like, it's really only people who are already in the know who are going to these things. So maybe it would have gotten bigger, but as it is, you know, 480. It's unfortunate it did sell out. It probably would have gotten up to 600-ish, I feel like. Somewhere around there, most likely. I do think there's a pretty big player base down in Melbourne. So I think, like, you know, there's a lot of locals who are probably pretty excited to get to play. And so hopefully a lot of Australian players got to get into this. It definitely would be bummed out for anyone who, you know, because they don't have that many regionals anyway, right? So like,
yeah, this is one of their,
it's like one of their few chances. Like, even if it's someone who just wants to go play in a Pokemon tournament, not someone who cares about getting their world's invite, someone who just wants to go have the experience of doing it, which is the majority of people who play in Pokemon tournaments, to be honest. People who just want the experience of being able to do it. They don't care about their world's invite. They don't care about winning. They just want to go play. You know, and there's less room for those people in the tournament when these tournaments sell out in an hour.
Yeah, yeah, it's unfortunate. Hopefully, but hopefully this is like an indicator to, you know, TPCI and the tournament organizers that actually this like year in total so far and the way things are looking, like if you look at Orlando regionals right now, it has 1,700 people. It is on track to be the biggest, I think it just will be the biggest Pokemon tournament ever, especially once you include like VG. Oh, in North America, besides everywhere besides Japan, the biggest tournament besides tournaments in Japan, because I don't think we'll ever be able to match them. Maybe one day, we'll see. Biggest tournament ever besides in Japan, and I think VGC is also hitting record numbers as well far, because they had their biggest tournament ever in San Diego, I believe, and I think this is gonna surpass that for them as well in this one. And I think they've maybe hit their cap for Orlando. I'm actually not sure. They might still have some slots left. If not, hopefully, if there's extra TCG ones, they give them over to the VGC players. But yeah, Orlando's going to be massive. I hope it's not crowded. That's what I'm almost scared of at this point, is that it's going to be a super crowded venue. And we've had a couple of those so far. Like, San Diego was pretty packed. Baltimore was definitely crowded, which is like, how many players are in there? And Baltimore was terrible too, because there's like one door in and out.
Yeah.
And like, you just couldn't easily get outside. But like, for like San Diego, after every round, I was leaving the venue hall and going outside because it was like kind of hot in there. And there was just so many people in there. Yeah. So hopefully Orlando has like a big, hopefully they're doing it right and they have a big, big venue to work with. And then hopefully future events going into this season, I mean, everything's kind of been booked and stuff. So hopefully this is a good indication of how big the game is and how big it could possibly be, how much bigger it could be possibly next season. And then tournament organizers, TPCI, get bigger venues to accommodate for all the players who want to play Pokemon.
Yeah, I do think we have to give props there, right? Because the whole beginning of this season, we talked about, you know, tournaments selling out super quick. That hasn't really been the case the last couple of regionals. And like the regionals that are currently registering, you know, Knoxville also has like 1,100 players, you said, right? Already registered.
Yeah, 12.
1,200 players. It hasn't capped. So, I mean, it seems like, you know, maybe Pokemon was able to find a solution, maybe able to, and that's including now VGC being a part of these tournaments as well, which was not the case for the first few, where it was a problem at the start of this season. So yeah, shout outs to Pokemon and the organizers for, you know, kind of trying to find a solution, getting more spots available. And it's, you know, seems like people who want to play are going to be able to play. And it makes me curious what's going to happen for NAIC, because traditionally NAIC or Nationals previously is the biggest tournament of the year. So if we're sitting at 1,700 in Florida, now there is a pretty big player base in Florida already, a big casual player base as well. But Ohio's pretty easy to get to, right? Assuming that it is going to be in Columbus, which, you know, it has been always in the past. So, or the last few years at least. But yeah, assuming it's in Columbus, like, it's going to be a, it's going to be a big one. Are we going to see a our first ever 2K player tournament potentially in AIC this year, Azul?
I mean, I don't see why not, especially, I mean, as long as there's the room for it. I think that's going to be the question more so than anything, right? As long as they have the space, as long as they get the big enough hall and have enough space for all the players, I think we could get over 2,000 players possibly, for sure. I think it's definitely possible. If Orlando's any indication, which I think it is an indication of that, like, we could definitely get 2,000 players for NAIC. And I think most, if not all, I'm probably not all, I think most of the, still most, even though we have had better registration times for, not times, but like people being able to register for these events more easily, things haven't been selling out in like 20 seconds. I think most of the North American regions, at least, have capped on, you know, eventual registrations have eventually capped. So we're still pushing the towards the cap every time, which is good to see. But yeah, NAIC could be ridiculous for sure.
One thing I actually did want to talk about, that what our discussion just now made me think of it. In the past, for NAIC, it's a tournament that's always flighted, right? So there's always two pods. Like, I think it's in the past been like an orange pod and a blue pod, or yellow pod and a blue pod, something like that. And they take the top 32 from each pod, or X2 ones, which it's usually still, of course, just 6-2 ones or better, 19 match points or better. And from each pod makes it into day two. So it's really like there's two big regionals happening at the same time in the room. Do you think that we would ever see them do that for regionals, like at Orlando? Like, is there a benefit to them? I guess the question is like, what's the benefit to them even doing it in the first place? Does it require more judge staff for that many people? But like, you know, if we have 1,600 masters in Orlando, would it make more sense for there to be 2 800 person pods than for just one 1,600 person tournament?
Well, I think the question would be, why do they do it at Nationals? Because they've done it at Nationals too, like before even NAIC. It was done at Nationals, it's done at NAIC. The question is, why do they do it there? Because we've hit numbers greater than there has been at previous U.S. Nationals, and now we're getting numbers equal to NAIC. Because how many players did we have at what's the previous biggest? Arlington was, right? Arlington was the biggest regional ever, and that was as big as some NAICs we've had, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, at 1,200, right?
Arlington.
Yeah, and that was bigger. That was bigger than the NAIC that just happened.
Right.
So the question would be, I mean, it doesn't. I don't think it requires more staff. Maybe it's a little bit more work to set up the room, and maybe they never thought about doing that regional, so like the regionals tournament organizers aren't prepared to do that. But if they, the question would just be, why did they do it at NAIC? Because theoretically there's no reason to, right? I guess theoretically in the past when it was U.S. Nationals and those tournaments used to get like, I don't know, 1,000 players, I want to say, and then regionals back then only used to get like, I mean, not that many players. Regionals back then only used to get like I don't know, like 200, 200, a few hundred, 100, 200 players. So like, was it just, oh, we have so many people, we should do two pods. Like, how are we going to handle this as one tournament? We should pod these players. And they did that. And maybe just kind of kept like on as a kind of like, not a tradition, but it's something they've always done at Nationals. And now it's become an AIC. And they just always do it there. But they never stop to think, oh, wait, Regionals are getting as many players or more players than NAIC or what Nationals used to be. Why would they not also make the Regionals that get that big into two pods? It doesn't make any sense to not do it, right? And so I'd be curious to know, what is their reasoning to do it at Nationals and NAIC? Because to be honest, I don't really see a reason for them to do it there if they're not doing it for the Regionals as well.
Yeah, on it, and also I just pulled up the tournament rules handbook, which lays out, you know, if there's X number of players, there's X number of Swiss rounds plus day two, yeah. Right? And there's actually not anything that I can see, at least in here, about podding or flighting tournaments, right? Separating it into two pods or two flights. So I think that's like something they have to go in and like manually do, and then like manually create. Like I've always heard before that they have to like do some kind of wizardry to like get people to keep their same records going into day two of the internats and stuff like that, because they're combining two tournaments, which is not something that like Tom, the tournament organizer, the tournament software, I should say, is like set up to do naturally, I guess. Like they have to do some kind of like finagling to make it work.
Turns out Tom is an AI that actually controls all the people who work for Pokemon, and everything has been has been controlling everything this whole time.
Tom makes all the decisions.
Yes.
Oh, we can talk about this another time, I guess. But remember we talked about PEM, the new like tournament software, a few episodes ago, like just kind of briefly mentioned it. I did have my first experience with it at that GLC tournament the other weekend, and there was like a few hiccups. We can talk about that another time. We don't have to get into that now.
Oh, so organizers, like local organizers, have access?
Yeah. Local organizers use it currently, but regionals don't.
Oh, I didn't know that. Regionals
still use Tom.
I mean, there's a reason that they don't use it at regionals. Then it must be that it's not very good yet.
And the guy who he was telling me some stories about like how at a pre-release, like they had four or five players that were literally entered into the software one time by him. But then when the tournament got paired, they were each in there three times, and there was just no fixing it. Like it was just like, whoever gets paired against this person is going to have to get a buy. They can't fix it.
This is how Tom is going to take over the world. Tom has been unleashed, and this is the form that it's taking. And this is how AI destroys, takes over
all
the world
because
right
of
here.
Pokemon's tournament software. Yeah. That's it.
We definitely should talk about that on a future episode for sure. I was going to say, what were we just talking about? We're talking about... I heard somewhere, someone mentioned to me, I don't know when, is that there is a Brown Plus at 2,000 players. But it's not... Is it in the handbook. Yeah, I've heard someone mentioned that to me recently. And I remember it being like a decently reputable source who like maybe would know that. I forget who it was.
Maybe it's like an internal discussion that has gone down at some point, right?
Yeah, they said when you hit 2,000 players, you go to... It's either you go to 10 rounds. I think it's you go to 10 rounds. I think it's 10 rounds day one if you have a 2,000 player tournament. But if they always pod the tournament, we're never going to have a 2,000 person tournament.
Yeah, so, in the rule book, what I can see, or in the tournament handbook, the only way you get a 10th round of Swiss is if you're doing a single day tournament that has over 410 players. That's what this says, at least. So if there's over...
So that's a big league cup.
yeah, big league cup, right?
Maybe like, Florida one day would hit those big of league cups. Because Florida
back
always
whenever,
has
like
masters.
States existed or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Like a tournament that just wouldn't have day two Swiss, but...
That's true, yeah. States these days would maybe hit those numbers.
Yeah, for certain
somewhere,
areas.
Maybe
like
one.
Texas probably, right? Florida.
Maybe Florida.
Yeah.
Definitely see it. Maybe if they ever, if League Cup marathons ever come back, I could see some of those getting pretty big.
For sure.
In a while, though. All right. Well, let's, I think that's it then on that. Let's move on to some Liverpool discussion. So Liverpool happened over the weekend and was taken down by Mew. Mew won the whole thing. I know I wasn't too hype on, I haven't been too hype on Mew. I think I even mentioned in the podcast last week that I wasn't a huge fan of Mew. But not only did one win the whole tournament, but there was two in the top eight. And you know what? I think the biggest thing for me is in my head, I always think about, one of the biggest reasons I'm probably not a huge fan of Mew is because The last four tournaments, I've played Lost Box Kyogre, which has a really good Mew matchup, and I've kind of been beating up on Mew for a while. I think its Lugia matchup is like 50-50, and I kind of have this idea in my head that Lost Box is favored against Mew, but I actually don't think Lost Ray, which is the most popular bit of Lost Box, is actually favored against Mew. I actually think it might be unfavorable, because I can't imagine how Lost Ray could easily deal with Path Roxanne at the end of the game.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, Lost Box Kyogre, I think it beats it. But yeah, I was like, I was giving more thought to it. I was like, I don't know, Mew did pretty good this weekend. Like, maybe what am I wrong on here? And I think one of my things is that I've been playing so much Lost Box Kyogre and beating up on Mews so much recently that I'm not as big of a, like, I just feel like Mew's not that as good of a deck as it actually probably is. And then also, like, the most popular build of Lost Box, I think Lost Ray, I think actually is probably unfavored against it. So that's like my personal probably shift on opinion on it. So I don't think Mew's terrible right now. And yeah, I mean, it won. So there's that.
Yeah, and it you talked about how maybe we were a little wrong about Mew, or at least you were. We were both wrong for sure about Gudra. We see two Hisuian Gudra V-Star in top eight, and neither of us was super hype on the deck, like thought it was fine. But I mean, personally, I don't feel like it has a great Mew matchup. Its Lugia matchup is probably close, right? But we saw it do pretty well at this tournament, and obviously one of the most notable players in the world, Stefan Ivanov, chose to play it as well, and he was the first seed heading into top eight at a 10-1-3 record. I think after going 8-0-1 in day one or something like that, maybe 8-1, 8-0-1, he had a really good record. I know 8 wins for sure. So I mean, yeah, Gudra very ended up being pretty solid for this tournament. I think we did see in the finals kind of on display that it's Mew, like, you've got Drapion, but like, I just don't feel like that matchup's that good for the deck.
I didn't watch the finals. That's what I bot reviewed most of Liverpool. I've not bot reviewed any of Top Cut. With the draft, even with the Drapion, I don't know if it actually is pulling out the dub super consistently against Mew. Although it definitely helps quite a bit.
Stefan, yeah, I'm not sure, to be honest. Almost win game one, and I mean, I won't spoil it if you're gonna review it on your channel and you want to see it and stuff. But it was he could have definitely won game one, but just didn't quite pan out.
Yeah, and both of the Gudra Lost Box lists were, I mean, about as different as you can get for Lost Zone Gudra. One of them was very similar and almost, I want to say almost identical to Sosa's build, and that's kind of who's been hyping up Gudra recently, has been Israel Sosa and his brother Sammy Sosa. They both played it at San Diego, both got top 32, I believe. And this build looks like one card different than Sosa's list. But Stefan's build is actually, I mean, as different as you can get with Gudra Lost Box. There's not too much you can do. It's quite a bit different. There's no Marnies, heavier on the Roxanne, two Roxannes, and no Battle VIP pass, which I think is like the biggest difference between the two builds. Stefan rocking no Battle VIP pass, but four Quick Ball and four Capture Energy. So doesn't want to have to rely on the explosiveness of the Battle VIP pass for the trade-off of them being dead cards, potentially if you don't find one on turn one, being dead cards throughout the rest of the game. Instead, relying a little bit more heavily on the more consistent cards that can be more consistently used throughout the game. Also had the Luminion V in the deck as well, which is not great to put in play as like a tank kind of wall type deck. Yeah. You don't want to be giving up easy prize cards from your bench Pokemon as much as you can, but also playing the game is pretty good. Yeah. So, you know, finding your Colrus on, or the first Colrus on the first turn you can play, it's a pretty big deal. So I don't hate it for sure, but yeah, definitely pretty different. And it seemed, and also, no, actually another thing, no Parasol in Stefan's build. So the back and forth of the Rolling Iron plus Temple of Sinnoh, Stefan thinks is enough for the Lugia matchup, and that Yveltal is not as big of a threat that you need those Parasols.
Yeah, I think his hope is probably just like, annoy them as much as possible. Maybe they miss their Yveltal. And if they do hit Yveltal, hopefully I've slowed them down enough where I've had time to build up a second Gudra to respond. So it's like, okay, they get the one Yveltal KO. I'm not going to worry about having Big Parasol on my deck, making my deck less consistent. I'm going to focus more on the consistency, more on the straightforwardness of the deck. My opponent is going to eventually get a KO with the Yveltal on a Gudra, and then I'm going to KO the Yveltal and just be doing the same thing again.
Yeah, yeah. And then hopefully they can't keep up with that from there. Throw some Roxannes in there. Disrupt stuff. Like I said, Temple of Sinnoh can, yes, Temple of Sinnoh still now to slow down the Yveltal, or to stop the Yveltal completely until they can deal with Temple of Sinnoh, to slow down the damage from like powerful energy from the Lugia. So it was really cool to see the differences in Stefan's build, a little bit more straightforward. I'm usually more of a fan of lists that look like that.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely excited to try it out. I haven't quite tried out any games with
that. Yeah, no VIP pass. What's your first kind of take on that? No VIP pass.
I mean, I would prefer that. I hate Battle VIP pass. I think it's a terrible card for the game. And it just sucks to play. I mean, I've been playing Lost Box Kyogre the last four tournaments, and I played Battle VIP. I hate Battle VIP, so I wish I could not play it and then still play something like the Lost Box Kyogre. So I'm excited to see the no Battle VIP pass in Stefan's build, because the Lost Box deck, Guja's kind of cool. There's no Battle VIP pass, so I'd love to see that.
It's definitely the type of card that it's just annoying when that card is... Like, the format necessitates a card like that being played.
Yeah, it makes it really... Well, unless it's just, like, one deck. If there's, like, one really aggressive deck that plays it and that's it, then that's cool. But when it's, like, really good in so many decks or almost a must-play... Guja also won in seniors, actually, as well. Guja won in seniors. Rune, who's been killing it in the seniors division, takes down another major tournament in seniors. Going to be scary when they make their way up to masters. And they were playing something more similar to... So once again, the build that Vinny is the player who also got top eight with Guja alongside Stefan with the Battle VIP pass build, which I don't know if anyone else is hyping it up before Sosa, but I think Sosa was, as far as I know, Sosa is the originator of this kind of build of the Lost of Guja. So, yeah.
And Rune's list is really similar to the Sosa list and the other one we saw in top eight as well, with the VIP passes, the Marnies and stuff. I had double Cramorant in there, which is more unique, I think, than what most people have been playing. This has been kind of
Vinny also had the double Cram
deck. Oh, did okay.
Yeah, yeah. I think Sosa was rocking double Cram too. I think
Stefan's only playing one, but okay.
No, he's on double Cram. I think Stefan is the only lone Crammer.
And honestly, Cram is just kind of like okay in this deck, I feel like. So it makes sense.
Yeah.
Right? It's like your deck doesn't really care about putting damage in play so much. It just cares about setting up and getting to Guja. So it kind of makes sense that you don't rely on getting that Cramorant damage in play. It like can be nice. Obviously, it lines up some math for you to two-hit KO V-Stars and V-Maxes with Cramorant plus Guja. But, I mean, I feel like in Stefan's case, he's probably most of the time just like, if I get it off turn one, that's fine. If I prize it, you know what? It's okay. I'm still going to just get to Guja.
Yeah. Also, another thing in Stefan's list, had the Goon. Actually, I'll even mention this on the winning in. Actually, Benjamin Pham, who's a pretty notable name, was on the winning in with Guja, and had a pretty unfortunate game three. Was definitely going to win game three. Unfortunately, they tied. But at the beginning of game three, they're playing up against Magnus Peterson, mm-hmm. Who's also a pretty notable name. And Magnus left their lone Mew in the active, and of course, Benjamin plays Drapion and went to go search it out, and it was prized and probably would have just won instantly in that game three if it wasn't prized. So there's almost more Guja action in day two than just Stefan and Vinny. There's probably a couple more in the day two as well. But I guess that kind of begs the question, right? Moving forward, like, is Guja a deck? Like you said, you still don't think you're too hype on it personally. I need to play with it a little bit more.
I didn't say I wasn't too hype on it. I said I wasn't hype on it previous to this weekend. I think like
it's... but you were saying the Mew matchup and Lugia matchup.
Oh, like... sure. Yeah, I don't think it's. I think it was fine for this tournament because I don't think Mew was like going to be as popular as it has been for this event. But
yeah,
now that Mew won, maybe that's not the case so much anymore, right? I think it's like Lugia matchup is okay. I think that its Mew matchup is unfavored for sure, but
yeah, and that's another thing to mention. Mew won in Europe again, and not just in Europe, but it also, I mean, like, it got at San Diego regionals, second place. And it's all the DTE build. There was two Mew in top eight of Liverpool. One was the DTE build, very similar to Nathan's list, actually.
I think it's like
very close.
I was trying to find differences really quick. I think it
might not be one. Oh, it's one Marnie over a judge.
I think that might be it. Yeah, that was the one difference I could find right off the bat. But I mean, it's got the same stadium count in here, two Lost City, two Path, and the one collapsed as well. Mm-hmm. Obviously, same Pokemon lineup because that's kind of just been the staple of this version of Mew, but.
Yeah, actually, I think that's the only change is one Marnie over that the third judge.
Yeah.
What do I want to go for that? Oh, yeah. I was going to say, yeah. Mew, another dub in Europe. But also, people had Drapions this time, right? Stefan had the Drapion. Kim, which is one of the Lugia players who made top eight. There was two Lugias in top eight, had a Drapion. Yeah. Vinny had a Drapion. So there's a lot of Drapions in top eight. Last time we kind of joked around. European players must have forgot their Drapions, and that's why Mew won, because no one had Drapion, not even the Giratina lists that everyone was running Drapion and had Drapions.
Yeah.
And even when the Europeans bring their Drapions, it's not enough to stop the Mew, apparently. And Mew got the dub there, which is actually it's kind of funny. Yeah. And I guess moving forward, I think Mew is like, I feel like we got to respect it as like a topic. I don't think there's too much you can throw at it unless everyone's bringing Drapion, like we kind of saw the week of Arlington regionals. If that happens, I would recommend leaving your Mews at home. But I don't know if we're ever going to see that much Drapion in a tournament again.
Yeah, and Mew does have enough stuff to beat Drapion, right?
Yeah, it's pretty tough.
And it is, but we saw, again, you haven't seen it yet, but in the finals, you know, the answers that that Leon played were enough to kind of dismantle the Drapion and disrupt and make it harder for Stefan. So, you know, I mean, sometimes it doesn't, your answers are kind of like soft answers, right? Like leaving past the peak and play. Obviously, if you just lost City it and they can't do it again, going like Roxanne plus lost City, that's the main strat you want to go for. But if you just like the turn before they're going to attack with it, path, you're forcing them to find one more piece to try to even attack with the Drapion on that turn. And sometimes they're not going to get it. Sometimes they're not going to get it. And that's going to be enough to, you know, even if they do the next turn get Drapion, you're too far ahead.
Yeah, and sometimes you can do like weird plays where you like leave it in play and you go like double cross switcher Roxanne path yourself and go KO their Goodra off the bench instead of KOing the Drapion and just leave it in play under a path. So yeah, it's not impossible to do.
Two cards and no way to like, they have to draw the stadium off too.
Yeah. So yeah, we were wrong about Goodra for sure. One thing we were right about is like one thing I kind of talked to last week was like why I think nobody should play Lugia basically. And I mentioned that I think if we see Lugias in top eight, it'll probably be names we've seen before. And that is what happened. Raz Walp and Kim Pobega. I think I got that right. Mm-hmm. Definitely names we've seen before in top cut situations are the only Lugia players in top eight. So two, you know, known players in the top eight. Like that's not a surprise to me. And Lugia did okay overall at the event. And I actually want to like expand a little bit further on kind of that thought process in mind of like why I don't think anyone should play Lugia. It really is like just because of how popular that is. I think if Lugia was like played at a 10 to 15% rate, I think it would be like, it would make a lot of sense for a lot of players to play Lugia. But I think because of how popular it is and how many mirror matches you have to go through, it just makes it a pretty RNG play into any major tournament right now. So I just want to expand a little bit further on my thought process on why I don't think anyone should really be playing Lugia. But if everyone took my advice on that, then the number of people who played Lugia would come down enough to where I think it would actually be good to play Lugia. But no one will ever do that. So Lugia will probably be, probably was 30% at this event and probably will be 30% even potentially, yeah, until probably rotation, right? Crown Zenith, I don't think it's changing much.
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if at Orlando it dips below the 30. I think it's still going to be high, like over 20.
Was it like 29 at Arlington? So it's been under 30.
Yeah,
but
yeah. But I mean, I'm saying like, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see it in that like the 22 to 25 range in Orlando. I mean, especially with how massive the tournament is as well, right? Like,
I don't think that changes anything, right? That bigger tournament, I don't think changes the percentage. I think
I guess it
smaller
on
tournaments,
who the players are, right?
Yeah. Well, I think smaller tournaments is like if you saw like a 100-person tournament, if Lugia was 15%, that would make sense. It wouldn't be a surprise. But as long as we're hitting these 1,000-person regionals over and over and over again, I think Lugia will consistently be in the 30% range. Unless enough people come around on it and agree with me that it makes no sense to play Lugia when it is at 30%, and then we all kind of wait for it to dip down below 20 before we decide to pick it up. But I don't think it's ever going to happen. I think it's going to stay around 30, and a lot of people just like playing the most powerful deck. You can't hate on it. It's a really powerful deck. Do some cool stuff. So I think we'll keep seeing. I guess one thing we should mention while we're on the topic of Lugia is like the cool text that we saw.
Yeah, that was one thing I was going to bring up, because this is something you talked about last week about having an answer for the Duraludon is probably worth it for this tournament. Reasonably Redactyl's popular deck, well. And we saw the Lugia, yeah, and the Aerodactyl, right? And we saw both the Lugias in top eight. Kim and Raz both had Canceling Cologne in the deck.
Yeah, both had the Canceling Cologne. Talked about it last week. Really good answer to the Aerodactyl. Good against Weezing. Good against, what's the other one? Duraludon. Arceus Duraludon. So it kind of answers all of
like,
those.
You can do stuff with like Boss Manaphy Cologne, right? But that's like a little more unreasonable, but it will happen sometimes, I'm sure.
The card that I didn't think too much about that Raz actually played. So Kim played two Canceling Clones. You need to find it, right? You need to find the card to actually answer some of these situations, like the Weezing and the Aerodactyl specifically. But something that Raz played, and we also saw Tord playing a different card that did this, but Raz played an Irida. And the Irida allows you to search out an item card and a water Pokemon. So the water Pokemon's not as relevant. Could be relevant. Maybe you want a Lumineon, maybe you want a Manaphy. But the important part is you can go Lumineon V to get Irida, to get your Canceling Clone, or your Lost Vacuum, or your Choice Belt for those like very niche situations for those item cards, right? So it helps you get access to these very important item cards on those turns. Like when you need that item card, you need that item card, right? So gives access to that. Tortoise playing Skyla instead of the Irida. But when you only ever really need to really find the item card, the Irida being able to find like a follow-up Lumineon or Lumineon in general or the Manaphy, I kind of like the Irida almost a little bit more. But Skyla can get any trainer card, but the only other trainer card would be that's not an item card in the deck is a supporter card. So you'd basically be playing Skyla to get boss, to use boss next turn would be like the play, I guess. But I guess like the Irida could get the Lumineon for the next turn, which would do the same thing.
Yeah, it's actually really funny because I was in a coaching session with a student this week. We were talking about a Lugia deck. We were talking about putting Canceling Cologne or something like that in the deck. And I was saying something about, like, you want to be able to find it. What about, like, what are the options in the format? And we looked at it. We talked about Irida and Skyla as both of the options. And then my student was literally like, this just has to be bad, right? And I was like, I mean, you're probably right. Like, but it's like one of the things we just kind of were talking through. And it turns out, you know, maybe Irida is not too bad. And other people were kind of having the same wavelength, same thought. And yeah, the Irida definitely makes more sense than the Skyla being able to find the Lumineon or the Manaphy in the matchup that you wanted in, matchups that you wanted in. Yeah, definitely a cool tech. And the fact that Raz played two Lumineon meant you could Lumineon for an Irida at one time if you needed it. Or you could even chain them together, right? You Lumineon for Irida. Yeah. Irida gets the other Lumineon to get you a different
supporter. And the Canceling Cologne or whatever.
Oh, so good. Yeah. So good.
Hey, Chip, you just need a you just got talked out of it, man. You're on point. You know what you need to do.
But talked
you
just have out to of it by my own student.
Yeah. Chip, you got to surround yourself with the right people to hype you up, hype up your bad ideas. Maybe they're not so bad.
And then
it is funny, though, for sure.
The rest of top eight, we've got a Rayquaza Lost Box making it into top four. Mikey Block with the Rayquaza build. Really similar to Pablo's build from top eight of San Diego. Doesn't have the four escape rope, has just three. Doesn't have double Raikou, just the one. But like other than that, I mean, it's obviously, I think, pretty inspired by that. And I mean,
I we're getting to the point where these are,
what's up,
most people are just like taking Pablo's list and making adjustments. I feel like Pablo's list was really good,
for sure.
It's a good baseline.
So just one though in top eight, no Kyogres, and Sablezard I think is long gone at this point, so no Kyogres in cut. And we don't have all of day two just yet. I don't know those statistics of like what decks were in day two, so I'd be curious to see like what the split was of like Kyogre versus Rayquaza, but it definitely feels like Rayquaza is the place people are going at this point. And do you think that I guess is in part to the difficulty of Kyogre? It's like a little bit harder of a deck to pick up than Rayquaza is.
I think, I mean, that could be part of it for sure. I also don't know how much better Kyogre is than Rayquaza. I still prefer it, I think, if I had to pick between the two, but I don't think it's like that much better than Rayquaza. And I think, the difficulty, Kyogre is definitely way more difficult than Rayquaza.
So if it's like a marginal difference, like if Kyogre is like 0.5% better, but Rayquaza is like 30% easier to play, you're getting diminishing returns if you're at a certain
point. At some point, right? It probably makes more sense to just play the Rayquaza for sure. Definitely, I agree.
Strain you put on yourself playing Kyogre every single round. And then,
does hurt the brain for sure.
And then the other deck to make top eight, I mean, it's pretty much just a given. When you're looking at a European regional championships, you're going to see seven players and then Sander Waljik in there with the control.
And does it again. And this one was kind of similar to what Sander brought to LAIC. Going back to the Quad Yveltal Snorlax, no Mewtwo V Union this time around, but bringing a different answer for the Lost Box deck. Instead of rocking the SQ, brought a Ice Cube. Instead of the Ice Cube, brings the Flying Pikachu VMAX Thornton combo to try and get that set up in a single turn. Or as I've kind of watched the game and kind of thought about it more, hey, benching Flying Pikachu against a Lost Box deck like isn't that risky. And if they go after it, that's when you can kind of play for the Thornton play. Also has the unfazed Fat Snorlax in here as well to kind of offer some Pokemon that you can kind of put in play that the most Lost Box decks can't actually touch, and you can kind of leave it on your bench and build up energy to Thorn into, use it as an attacker, or prevent your opponent from kind of like setting up a ton of damage in play on your board and kind of wiping your board in one turn with Sableye, because you are trying to get down to that lone flying Pikachu V-Max board state, so that way the most popular build of Lost Box, Rayquaza, can't go like Escape Rope or Escape Rope Boss and one hit KO your flying Pikachu. So that's kind of your setup. And then to find all these pieces, they got the Starly in here with the Keen Eye, so you can actually find these cards. Because there's no actually way to find the Flying Pikachu VMAX in this list besides Keen Eye or drawing into it. So,
yeah, I thought that was one of the more interesting things. You just got to hope to draw into it or set up with the Starly. And it makes sense, right? Like, usually you would think a setup card like Starly is not going to be useful because your opponent's just going to Marnie you, right? But you think about the matchup where you want Flying Pikachu the most. It's probably good against Reggie's, right? It's probably good against Reggie's. They're going to probably Marnie you, but Lost Box doesn't play Marnie. So it's like, you're pretty free to just Starly set up you can literally pretty easily set up Thornton plus Flying Pikachu, right?
Yeah. It doesn't seem too difficult at all, to be honest, with the Starly. Yeah. They don't play any hand disruption. Reggie's going to be a different story.
Yeah.
Going to go down the same strategy though, trying to get the Flying Pikachu set up, and into the active, which will be a little bit more difficult. Because Reggie's has gust effects, more than one gust effect to bring up the Flying Pikachu V if you just put that in play first.
Yeah.
And they have Marnie, so they can disrupt your big Thornton play at some point as well. But I imagine the deck can get there a decent amount of time. Another thing cool about like the Flying Pikachu as your answer to those two matchups as well is you can actually play three games potentially because you're actually drawing prize cards. So you could concede one game really fast and still potentially get two games in there to win because you actually can draw six prize cards. That is your win condition once you get the Flying Pikachu online. So another really cool control deck from Sander, like some of the stuff we've seen before from him. And I guess I would mention, Sander mentioned in their tweet of the list that they actually submitted the wrong list. In the end, this is the list that they had submitted, but then said in a follow-up tweet that they had made another list on Arcane 9 and forgot to submit it, but they would have gone -1 Truck and Choose, -1 Crushing Hammer, and 2nd Sydney, and a 4th Speed Lightning Energy. So if you're picking this Sander control build up, play the what would have been Sander's probably preferred build and take those cards out and put in the other cards. I don't think it doesn't sound like Sander would have played this build if they had the choice. So 2nd Sydney does seem pretty strong right now. It's definitely a big part of your Mew matchup and your Lugia matchup. So make the changes if you want to be playing what Sander would have played. But still, I mean, even if you're playing the deck you're not, wouldn't have played and you still made top 8, you can't really complain, right?
Yeah, for sure. And one thing I did think was interesting from this thread is that because Stefan is the one who asked about, you know, the one Crushing Hammer. I think that's the big question. People see this list. They're like, what the heck is happening? One Crushing Hammer in this deck. And obviously, Sander said that's one of the cards he would cut. But he said it's like, you know, if you hit it, it's going to be good, which I think is pretty obvious, right? this tweet specifically where he says, opponent, assuming I play multiple, can cause them to play too conservatively. Mainly works because of my reputation. Just seeing one hammer, along with how likely I obviously am to play a lot of disruption, can prompt the assessment to play around multiple hammers. And I thought that was super interesting, right? It's like capitalizing on the reputation, capitalizing on the fact that everyone's going to be being more conservative because who's playing one Crushing Hammer, right? And then you just get to commit those spots to better cards, right?
Yeah, I mean, the card I'm actually most interested in is the Echoing Horn. I saw the one Crushing Hammer, but I also saw there's two Regieleki with Electromagnetic Sonar. So you can repeatedly just use the Crushing Hammer over and over again. So my thought was just like, there's probably some situations where Sander like gets something stuck in the active, and the way the opponent can move it is by actually attaching energy to it to retreat it eventually, or set up the attacker on the bench to build it up. So that's why you just repeatedly use the Crushing Hammer. That's why I thought there was a one Crushing Hammer in there. Apparently it shouldn't have been in there, and it's just used to hopefully get a heads against Mew, and that's kind of all you're doing is trying to get really cheesy. But yeah, the card I was actually most curious about is the Echoing Horn. I'm curious as to that. I think in the Lugia matchup it seems decent to try and trap something in play eventually, but it seems like in most matchups it doesn't really do a whole ton. So that's the one I'm actually most curious about. But yeah, the power of the unknown, I think Sander was able to take advantage of, I guess, with the Crushing Hammer. People were just expecting 2, 3, and 4, and they just never came.
Yeah, the Echoing Horn, I guess, is just for randomly trying to trap something. I think maybe Echoing Horn would maybe make more sense if he played the Block Snorlax in here or something like that. Because there's theoretically a win condition there of, like, your opponent discards something that can't attack, and if you just go boss, put Block Snorlax active, that can just win you the game.
Yeah,
But and then it's the same like ultimate win condition against most things, it feels like, that we saw from his deck at LAIC, where, you know, obviously matchup dependent what you want to attack with, but in the non like lost box matchups, you're eventually going to get to a spot where you're using Eldegoss plus Birdkeeper turn after turn after turn to replenish your deck and eventually take all of your prize cards. Now, I will say, instead of having, so in LAIC, Sander had Pukumuku to guarantee draw both of the cards, right? So he would be able to go, Pukumuku, like he Eldegoss puts back the Eldegoss plus the double turbo energy, then Pukumuku guarantees draws both of those two cards next turn, then Eldegoss Birdkeeper do the whole thing. Now instead he's got the second Eldegoss in here, which effectively does the same thing, right? Because you're always going to be putting Eldegoss back in, so that means you'll always have the other one in hand, or, you know, maybe you have it in play and that means you have Birdkeeper in hand, so you can always just get into, you know, you can play Birdkeeper to be able to draw the cards to be able to continue the Eldegoss loop turn after turn.
Yeah, just Eldegoss into Eldegoss. Yeah, I actually didn't even realize that there wasn't a Pukumuku in here, because there's almost always a Pukumuku in Sander's deck. But there's usually also a lot of trekking shoes as well, and this time there's just one shoe. So Sander not trying to play, you know, a 56-card deck, or I guess you could get down to 55 with the Pukumuku, trying to play some more cards. The resources a little bit more valuable in this build this time around. But yeah, another cool Sander deck for sure.
Definitely a cool one. And did it also keep the Miltank in here as just kind of a general wall, which, I mean, if there's a decent amount of Gudra, Miltank's pretty good against Gudra.
They got the Cramorant,
right? But like, if you can deal with the Cramorant, I guess they've got Ordinary Rods and stuff. Maybe it's not as good.
It's good to slow down the Luminion loop from the Lugia matchup, because everyone has double Luminion now. So if they're just going Luminion to Luminion over and over again, that can be a little bit tough to deal with. So Miltank stops that to slow it down so you can find your Sydneys or boss up a Archaeops or a Lugia or something. So Luminion's always good for that.
But yeah, that's the top eight decks from Liverpool. We don't have all of the day two stats, so we can't really talk about like the percentages and stuff like that just yet. But one deck I did want to mention, I couldn't find it on Twitter. I know I saw it on Twitter, and they were streamed, so you could go find the stream from round 11. Yep. But that was a Cherum Snorlax deck. And the player ended up getting top 64. Massive shout outs, absolute mad lad getting top 64. Joe Yates is the player's name. Yeah, super cool. Love to see people playing unique things like that. Snorlax Cherum Azul. I don't think anyone predicted that.
No, definitely not, especially not in day two. But I mean, Snorlax hits, like Snorlax 2 at KO's literally everything
does
in the
a
format.
Lot of damage, yeah.
And then so if you attack first, like you just win the trade, right? Like theoretically against a lot of decks in format, if you just attack first as the Snorlax deck, theoretically you just win. Like that's it, you just keep attacking and the game's over, as long as you can, like, you know, gust up some two prize Pokemon that maybe run to the bench that try to not get KO'd, and there's some Serenas in the build, like, yeah, you can pull it off. So that was really cool. Another one that I wanted to mention as well, so there was that one, was Alberto Conti's Lost Box deck that was like a turbo, it's just like a full turbo Lost Box. It kind of was like similar to Sablezard builds, but it was a Kyogre Mirage Gate build still, but had like eight switch cards. Yeah, Chip's got it pulled up now. It's got the double vacuums, two Pokestops. It's got the two of the four seal stones, four rope, four switch card. There's like turn one, turbo four, Mirage Gate to attack with Raikou or Dragonite, and then you follow up
or
with Sableye and Kyogre. Or Greninja. Yeah, I guess you could turn one attack with Greninja Demands. I didn't actually think about that one. But yeah. That's actually pretty good, too.
I would imagine that's probably one of the biggest ones, right? Because a lot of times people aren't expecting you to be able to, you know, especially if turn you're one. Playing a decent amount of mirrors, right? Like, I don't know about you, but when I was playing the mirror, I was never putting Manaphy down right away because, you know, there's you don't need to go out of your way to search it out, it feels like, most of the time. But if you're going second and you've got the ability to find the secret to the Lost Zone, get all those tools, that, you know, you with putting a stadium or tool in play plus Lost Vacuum, that's three cards in the Lost Zone.
It can
really rack up pretty quickly. So really cool build for sure from Alberto.
Yeah, no crams as well. Yeah. We're never attacking with Cram.
He's a chump.
I don't know. I actually would be curious to see if Alberta was choosing to go second most of the time, because they played up against a Reggie player, the stream match that they had. They played up against Reggie, and going into game three, they did choose to go second. Now, it was a weird situation where it was like they were low on time, and you got to be aggressive in those kind of situations. So that's maybe why Alberto chose to go second in that game. I wonder if they were choosing normally to go first, but I actually kind of like the idea of going second with this, like, especially like the surprise factor you probably just win a ton of games because your opponent, like, oh, they flipped over a Comfy. Okay, I'll open my Manaphy, bench one Lugia, pass, and then you're like escape rope, one hit KO with Dragonite, and just like steamroll them. So, yeah, some surprise factor for sure with this kind of build. Yeah, it was just a really cool build. So I wanted to shout out Alberto, and Alberto's been a pretty consistent performing player recently as well. So definitely one of the top European players as well, coming up with a cool Lost Box build.
Yeah, and someone who I don't think started playing until COVID. So like started playing like after the COVID era. So someone who's really kind of bursted onto the scene, made a name for himself. Shout outs to Alberto for sure.
All right, and that is Liverpool. Interesting tournament. The Gudra showed up. The Mew showed up. Lugia, of course, showed up as always. And going to see how stuff changes a little bit with Crown Zenith. We'll be talking about that in a second. But first, got to get into Guess That Flavor Text. This week, it's my turn to pick a card to read a flavor text of for Chip to try and guess what Pokemon card, what Pokemon belongs to that Pokemon card. We get 4 points if Chip is able to guess it without using the lifeline. There's 3 lifelines. And if Chip does use any of the lifelines, and for each lifeline Chip uses, it'll be -1 point. And the lifelines are what set the card is from, what stage the card is, and then read an attack name from the card. Don't have to be picked in that order. Chip can pick them in any order he wants. Chip, are you ready?
So ready. Let's do it. I mean, after you got 2 points last week, you tied.
We're just tied.
Tied it up. You know, I've got to... got to get back ahead. I've been in a lead for so long. It started to feel good, and now I've lost that feeling. I got to gain it back. Come on.
All right, Chip. Here we go. What makes it happy is imitating the voices of weeping people and scaring everyone. Wow. It doesn't deal well with folks who aren't easily frightened.
What makes it happy is people's sadness. Say it one more time.
What makes it happy is imitating the voices of weeping people and scaring everyone. It doesn't deal well with folks who aren't easily frightened.
Interesting. So, I mean, my first thought is a ghost type Pokemon. Yeah. I think that it could be just some other random, like, crying Pokemon, something that wants... like, what Pokemon is known for crying? Like, Sobble, I guess. It's definitely not Sobble. It makes me think of like one of the Pokemon that's like a doll, almost like a Banette or a Mimikyu, even something like that. But Mimikyu, I don't think is that, like, I don't know, it doesn't quite sound like a Mimikyu to me. I'm gonna use some lifelines for sure here. I'll start with what set the card is from.
It is from Silver Tempest,
a new card, okay, a newish card. Okay, I guess. Oh, could it be like an Esper or something like that? Or because there's that Meow stick that has the supporter ability, right, in Silver Tempest.
That card let me down so much when I tried it with the, what's it called? I was so frustrated trying to make that deck work. Card? With Serena?
Oh, Serena Breaks deck? In.
Yeah, Breaks In. I was trying so hard to make it good. It was just so hard to make good.
All right, I'm going to go with what stage the card is for another lifeline. I might be using all three here. We'll see.
It is a basic.
All right, at the moment, I think my front runner is probably Meowstic. That doesn't really sound like Meowstic, though. Or not Meowstic. What's it called? Esper. It likes... All right, let's go with read an attack name. Maybe this will give me a little bit of help.
Confuse Ray.
That definitely sounds like a ghost Pokemon, but like, also, why do I think that the Ralts in Silver Tempest has Confuse Ray? This does not sound like a Ralts, though. It does not sound like a Ralts. I want to say, because like, it's one of the older ones that people don't play the new Ralts, because there's like the old one that has teleportation, whatever, that like moves it to the bench, I think. Or is that one in Silver Tempest? It's got Confuse Ray. I don't know. I need to think of something.
I'm going to have to start whipping out the timer for you, Chip.
I know, apparently. I think I'm just going to go. I don't think this is right. I'm going to go with Esper, though. I just can't think of something else. Let's go with Esper.
It is not Esper. Yeah. It is Mischievous.
Mischievous.
Yeah.
That does make sense. I just didn't know... Yeah, this I didn't know what Pokemon were in the set. That was the main one, main thing. I didn't know for sure what was in the set. But that definitely makes sense. Yep, Mistrevious with Confuseray. So, unfortunately, yeah, no points for me this week. We remain tied, and Azul have a big chance to leap ahead for the first time in a long time next week, whenever I give him a guess. But...
Yeah, I read it and I was like, I feel like this suits Mischievous, but the one thing that I've been thinking about recently is like, I don't think, because like this is what you've been getting me on, is like, I know there's this card in this set, and that's like what kind of has been getting me recently when you've been getting them. I was like, I don't think Chip will know there's a Mischievous in Silver Tempest. Azul, I was like, okay, I think Mischievous is a good guess here.
Azul has found the guess that flavor text meta. He's figured out which lifeline helps me the most. All right. Yeah, points this week. Yep, we're all tied up. We'll see what happens next week if Azul can get back ahead on Guess That Flavor Text.
We're hoping. Everyone's rooting for me. All right, moving on.
Doubt it.
we're talking Crown Zenith, which is this the most underwhelming set ever?
Well, to be fair,
it's not a major set release.
It's not a set.
But like, when you compare it to the other collection, what are these called? What do you call these? Like collectible sets? Collector sets, like whatever these are called. What was the last one of these we had?
Shining Fates, Champion's Path. There's another one as well, I think.
Shining Fates was what was the last one though? Was it Champion's Path? That sounds familiar.
No, I mean,
that sounds...
Well, Champion's Path is older. That was like 2020. 2021 was Shining Fates. 2022, what was it? Was it this? No, there's something else for sure. Pokemon Go.
Oh, does Pokemon Go count as one of these sets?
Yeah, for sure.
That felt more like a. Remember the set where we got Victini Prism Star? That felt like one of those sets. Mysterious. Yeah.
That's what these sets are, brother.
No, but this feels. But that felt like a set with like. I guess maybe it's the same. No, because like that set just had like 32 cards in it or something, and it wasn't like focused on shiny cards.
More like a mini set. Okay, sure.
Yeah,
mini set as opposed to like a collector's expansion or something like that.
Yeah. No, so Shining Fates, that was the most recent one then? That was, like, not bad. It brought us stuff like, what did it bring us? It brought us Yveltal. Did it bring us Weezing? I'm looking, like, through the set list right now.
Yeah, I'm looking at, okay, so the last special sets, the non-main series expansions, it was Shining Fate, for the Sword and Shield series, we've had Champion's Path, Shining Fates, Celebrations, Pokemon Go, and then now Crown Zenith.
Okay.
So
this is the worst. This is definitely the worst. I think so far.
Well, no, Shining Fates didn't have anything. Shining Fates was just reprints.
It was 100% reprints?
No, but mostly. It was like...
I think we got like... I just like looked through some of it. We
there was
had
like Optimal Koffing was in here. Ascension Koffing was in here for the first time.
We got Yveltal, though. That was the first time we got Yveltal, right?
Oh, the Amazing Rares, sure. But they
the Amazing Rares.
Yeah. We did get the Amazing Rares, but to be fair, those have not been good up until recently, right?
Yeah, okay, that's true. So that could happen with, I guess, So there was nothing good initially then, I guess. Then. Maybe you are right. Maybe
Shining Fates, Crobat VMAX, Ditto V. It was like a very meh set.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah,
This might be better then.
Crown Zenith, I think, is probably a little better than this because like...
Yeah, that's fair.
The new Ultra Rares, I think, that came out in Crown Zenith are a little bit better than the new Ultra Rares that came out in Shining Fates. But I think most of the Ultra Rares that came out in Shining Fates... Yeah, it's like Cramorant VMAX, Ditto VMAX, and Ditto V, and Crobat VMAX.
Okay. I mean, I remember playing some Cram VMAX stuff when that first dropped. That was pretty fire.
Yeah, Delmize VMAX as well. So... Yeah, I think Crown Zenith, like, if you look at, like, Rotom V-Star, Zamazenta V-Star, like, they seem a little bit better, but they're not great. They're really not great.
Yeah. They're not. I haven't messed around with too much of the V-Stars yet. We have Regigigas as well. I messed around with Rotom, actually. I messed around with Rotom. Haven't messed with either of the Zam or the Zage, but Rotom was pretty cool, actually. The Rotom V-Star definitely is a pretty big buff to the Rotom V deck that has been around for a while. Like, the Rotom V-Star makes a pretty big difference. And actually, the biggest difference, I think, is actually Sky Seal Stone, because you got to play a lot of tool cards to begin with, and Rotom V is still, like, a really good attacker, even though you have the Rotom V-Star. It's, like, not that big of a difference. But the Sky Seal Stone, being able to draw, like, an extra prize up against the V-Maxes and the V-Stars, specifically very good in the Lugia matchup. So I've had some fun with the Rotom V-Star so far, and the Sky Seal Stone has been like a big difference in that. And that probably is the best card in the set, I think, is the Sky Seal Stone, for sure.
Yeah, and I think my opinion, at least going into the set release, was definitely Radiant Eternatus is the best card. And I think that was like kind of the way a lot of people were thinking as well. Radiant Eternatus is the best card. Because just on paper as well, it seems like the most unique card, the coolest one, the one that you can do the most stuff with. So far, I haven't really played anything with it yet, but I've like watched people playing with it and I've thought, like tried to, you know, think in my head of like different ways that it could be utilized and like competitively, like could this actually be good? And I just haven't really been able to come up with anything that I think seems like amazing yet. I think it seems very okay, but Sky Sealstone, I think, has definitely, you said it's probably the best card in the set, and I think I agree with that now. You know, I thought it was Eternatus, but I have played games with decks that use Sky Sealstone, and I mean, being able to like, I mean, first off, we'll just got to say, being able to put down against Mew, Drapion V, Sky Sealstone, and take four prizes on a Mew VMAX to win the game, like, that's just too good, right? That's too good.
Yeah, they don't even get a turn to Roxanne.
You I know.
You do something, and then you're
KO
like,
KO Genesect, right. Sky Sealstone, KO Mew, no Roxanne for you.
Yeah, so yeah, definitely the best card in the set. Yeah, Radiant Eternatus has been a little bit underwhelming so far, but this set just came out.
Yeah,
still time to mess. And when around. When there isn't a Lugia V-Star to just immediately start playing where the deck is given to you and like obviously it's known it's going to be a broken tier one deck, you got to work a little bit harder, right? So sometimes to discover some of these different how powerful some of these other cards are, like maybe something like the Regigigas V-Star, it takes a little bit more work for someone to come up with a viable enough list to actually consider playing it and make it work, right? You got to work a little bit harder for these kind of things. Not everything can be Lugia plus Archeops, stuff like the Regigigas and all the other stuff. You have to work. So yeah, you gotta work just a little bit harder to make them work.
Yeah, I remember when this card got revealed, we talked about it on the podcast, and you were like kind of excited about it. You thought it seemed pretty decent. Yeah. I mean, it's got a lot of HP and it does a lot of damage.
Yeah, and the Star Guardian V-Star power is like super cool. It's just like a really cool. Those are the things I wish we had more of, was more cool, unique stuff like that V-Star power, because I think the V-Star power is like super sick for sure. So yeah, I'm excited to try it out. I haven't done it yet, like I said, but. Think there might be some hope. Being weak to fighting also is like not that terrible right now. Being weak to fighting is usually like a pretty bad weakness in the Pokemon TCG. Yeah. Like the worst weakness is probably just fighting and then dark, right? Or it might be dark and then fighting.
Yeah, in the Pokemon TCG. Like historically, probably up there too.
Yeah, being weak to like fire or water is never too bad.
No,
they all have their times, but yeah, historically some are definitely worse than others. That's for sure.
So I want to talk about another big card in the set for sure, and that's the Zamazenta. I mean, I think that it's pretty obvious that this card is pretty decent in Lost Box, right? People were playing it in Japan already. Retaliate does a lot of damage if something was knocked out. I mean, this now becomes a pretty good response to Stoutland. The problem is, like, where does this fit in a Lost Box deck? And it's probably best alongside, like, Amazing Rayquaza. Already, because most of those decks were already playing Metal Energy if they were playing the Raikou as well, right? So this probably where this makes the most sense. It's a little harder to fit in something like Kyogre because you got to really change the energy types up because you're already playing three types. I don't know. Have you played anything with the Zamazenta yet?
I've actually played super very little of Crown Zenith. I've just been because I've been sick. I didn't even stream it as much as I liked. Yeah, and then I was VOD reviewing Liverpool, so I haven't done a whole ton of playing with the new set. Just played some Radiant Eternatus, Duraludon, and there's another deck that I mess around with as well. Oh, yeah, the Rotom V-Stars. Like, there's one more, the Rotom V-Star deck. So those are the only two decks that I've really played too much with. But yeah, Zamazenta is definitely another cool tool for Lost Zone decks. I don't think we'll see it in anything else because metal decks in general just aren't very good right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, can fit in the Lost Zone decks. But yeah, you do have to switch up your energy types a little bit, right? Because even in the Rayquaza deck, you only play like three metal energy, and this thing takes two metal energy. So even that is like a little bit costly in general. Like that can be hard to sequence out and consistently utilize in games. And then if you do it in the Kyogre build, which you've seen some Japanese builds where it's like Kyogre, Zamazenta, Sableye, which I think is viable. Like I think that actually seems pretty decent, to be honest. That's
just
like another thing.
No lightning attacker.
Yeah, no lightning attacker. So I think it's reasonable to mess around with. You lose the Dragonite, which I think actually the biggest loss there is the Dragonite V and not even so much the Zeraora.
Yeah.
Because Dragonite is just such a good card. But yeah, the Zamazenta I think is definitely solid and definitely will find its way into some builds of Lost Box for sure.
The Zamazenta is cool. Something else is the Zamazenta V-Star. I've seen some people talking about this. I don't think it's great right now. I actually think I saw Jake Gearhart talking about how this is like really good post-rotation obviously, like, I mean, you and me probably haven't thought much about post-rotation just yet. Try to focus on the main format. But, you know, Jake's always thinking like eight formats ahead, I feel like, right?
I've seen him talk about that on Twitter.
But yeah.
Maybe speaking of that, maybe that's where Reading Eternatus will become better. Is like when it's when rotation happens. Yeah.
Reading Eternatus is not as dominant.
Yeah. Because that like makes things a lot more difficult. But just getting out two VMAX Pokemon, like I actually thought about it. I think Radiant Eternatus is an extremely powerful card, but sometimes extremely powerful stuff just doesn't work depending on what the meta is, right? Like you don't have to put two, like not having to go, but you don't have to play one Quick Ball to get out to bypass the having to search out two V Pokemon, and then of protect them, not even have to protect them. And they immediately go into the V maxes where you don't even like have your opponent boss KO in your V Pokemon and not having to go search out two V maxes to evolve to your Vs. There's so much. If you use Radiant Eternatus successfully for two V maxes, that's like a ridiculous amount of value, right? It's just actually absurd.
Yeah.
The amount of value. But the V max Pokemon still have to be good in the meta. It's like, are they good enough is the question at that point, right?
Yeah. I mean, on paper, going to get out two, if this card existed back in the format where Shadow Rider Calyrex was dominating the format, like this card would have been insane, right?
Yeah.
Like in Urshifu formats as well, right? Like this card would have been super solid. But in the current format, it just seems like it's okay. I don't know. It's okay.
It's all right.
But we'll see moving forward. I mean, we do lose a decent chunk of the VMAXs with rotation, right? So it's like, if we're waiting on rotation for this card to be good, we're going to lose some of the things it can play with. Like, for me, one of the targets for it that I thought was the most intriguing was Orbeetle VMAX, being able to just get a couple of those in play and then honestly scoop up net the guy and do it again the next turn, right? Yeah, just get four Orbeetles in play. Like, that's kind of sick. But is it...
Cool.
Yeah, like...
The good sick.
Is it good sick? Right, exactly. And the answer is probably no. In a different format, maybe it would be, but we're never really going to know because this is the only format that those two cards will exist together.
Yeah, we'll never truly know, unfortunately. Yeah, I mean, I think there's, like I said, there's stuff out there from this set. And like you were mentioning, the Zamazenta, the V-Star is like, it's kind of cool to see the Zamazenta and Zacian get their V-Stars. It feels a little bit late, though. Like, I feel like that would have been a really good, like, I don't know. Everyone always talked about how broken Zacian was. I never thought Zacian was too broken. Zacian V. It would have been cool if we got these in, like, the middle of the season, right? To kind of, like, or the middle of the, wherever the we
block,
are now.
Yeah.
The block, in the middle of the block before rotation. Like, between Zacian V's release and rotation to kind of, like, bring them back into viability. But now we're getting at the end, and they're kind of, like, I feel like outpowered. The Zacian V-Star is still pretty solid overall, especially when you have the option of just staying at the V and using Brave Blade and Intrepid Sword in the early game and stuff like that. So, and then being able to like evolve to the V-Star and hit for like 310 damage is not bad, but I think it's not enough to keep up with what else, with everything else that's going on.
Yeah, I also thought the basic Zacian that's in the set seems kind of interesting too. Maybe in like some sort of Lost Box deck, if there was ever something where you wanted to just be able to do a lot into a specific VMAX matchup, right?
Yeah, we kind of already have like the amazing rarization for that, or Zamazenta for that, though.
Yeah, that is true. I guess it depends, because that requires three different energies, right?
Whereas
just requires two metal plus a colorless. So this is a little more flexible than that, probably. But, I mean, to be honest, like, it does 10 more damage to a VMAX than Dragonite does, right? So it's like,
yeah.
And Dragonite has more HP, survives Duraludon, which is probably one of the main reasons you would want this, right? This just gets KO'd by Duraludon. So yeah, I don't know. I thought this one was kind of interesting too, but it's, again, it's like cards that could have been good, but the format currently is just not right for them.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of those in this set, it feels like. It feels like they're just kind of outscaled in terms of power level.
And I think that's byproduct of the fact, like, Japan has had the Rotom for forever, right? The Rotom has been out, and we're just now getting it. That's like a buy, like, this set is definitely just like, okay, this is the last Sword and Shield block. We need to get all the cards that have come out in Japan over the last few years that haven't been put into something yet. We got to put them in here so we can release them. That's kind of what this feels like sometimes, is just like being able to, and which is good. You know, I would rather us get Rotom V-Star than for the card to have never been printed in English, but it's just kind of a bummer that it's getting printed 6 months after they got it in Japan. Right.
Yeah, definitely. And it does feel like a little bit with like our delayed rotation kind of syncing up closer to Japan's rotation and everything. It feels like it is definitely possible that they're trying to get us as close as possible to playing in the same format as consistently as possible. But I kind of like thought that, and I'm saying that now, but we're still 2 months out from Scarlet and Violet. And they just got Scarlet and Violet in Japan like this week or last week or something. Like they're playing with the cards. I saw, I think Hegster put a tweet out or something of him with opening up the Japanese cards. So, you know, they're rocking with the new EXs, and we're like 2 months, we're 2 months away still.
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny. The set came out in Japan the same day that Crown Zenith came out here. So the last English Sword and Shield set came out the same day as the first Japanese Scarlet Violet set. So it's like, just shows we're a little off sync there, you know?
Yeah, a little off sync. But maybe they're trying to get us closer, right? Like, I don't know. Hopefully, hopefully. If our rotations line up, that's a step in the right direction. And hopefully, maybe, I mean, one day, I don't see why it's not possible. Also, we're getting the same, we're getting silver borders, right? Like, we're getting, our cards look better, and look closer to theirs. Hopefully, and it shouldn't be impossible. One day, I feel like it's definitely possible, and I don't see why it's impossible, that our cards release on the exact same day that the cards release in Japan, and we're completely synced up. I don't see why that. I honestly don't see why that hasn't been this way this whole time.
Yeah.
But hopefully, moving forward, we actually get to that exact point.
Ever since I started playing, I've heard so many times, oh, "We're getting closer to global release. We're getting closer to global release." And I've been playing since early 2015, so or around sometime 2015. So
we're getting, I mean, we are closer. I feel like we're closer.
Yeah, maybe in 15, 20.
Will we ever get there?
Yeah.
Probably not before Tom
Generation
takes over.
22 or something like that. Before Tom takes over.
Yeah, I don't think we're gonna get there before Tom takes over. Tom will take over first.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Is there any other cards out of the new set to even talk about? I mean, we talk about the V Stars. I think like our last VMAX came out, right? Hatterene VMAX. That's pretty bad. Like there's prints of the Deoxys VMAX and the Zeraora VMAX in this set, right? Mm-hmm. Those cards are both like kind of interesting, but not that good. I mean, it's another situation of like, I mean, those have been out at least, right? Because they like were promos, but I don't know. I mean, I will say, for nothing else, like these sets that come out at the end of like the life cycle, or like the special collector sets at least, are so much fun to open up with the
cool artworks,
the full arts and special rares, the Galarian Gallery as it's called in this set, super super cool. Did you open up your packs already that Pokemon sent you?
Yeah.
Did you get anything good?
Nope.
You got nothing good?
There's nothing. It was
no
pretty bad.
Shot. Really? Yeah. You opened up like 20 packs or something, right?
Yeah, it was about 20. There was nothing. Nothing.
That's crazy. I got some sick stuff. Hang on. I'll just show it real quick because I got it sitting right here.
Well, but actually, like speaking of that though, like I'm all down for different artworks of cards and markers, but how some of these cards have like. The Raikou did look sick. I think my favorite artwork when I looked through them, because I looked through them, all the artworks before I opened my packs, was the Zoroark. The alternate art Zoroark.
The Zoroark is pretty dope.
Yeah. How many do some of these cards need like six different artworks? Like that like is weird to me. That's just so weird. Like I don't think we need six artworks. What does Scarlet and Violet look like for that? Is there alternate arts?
There's not rainbow rares. There's not rainbow rares. So we've at least eliminated that, which I think is a big part of why the pool feels diluted. But like, I mean, yeah, if you look at like Mew V, for example, because there was a new artwork of Mew V in this set.
Yeah.
So Fusion Strike Mew V got a new print, and then
it's only like three Mew Vs. I think it was a bad choice.
We've got the alternate art Mew V, we've got the full art Mew V, and we've got regular original Mew V. So there's four different arts of the same card, right?
Yeah, if you go to like Palkia V Stars and Zacians and stuff, it gets pretty ridiculous, I think. Like, listen, I get that. I don't know. It just seems like there's too much. Like,
yeah.
Like, why do we have five different Palkia V Stars? It just seems ridiculous. Like,
selling cards, making money.
Instead of paying people to make the sixth artwork of Palkia V Star, why don't you pay some people to, change, come up with ways to use the terrestrial mechanic in the Pokemon TCG. Pay someone to come up with an idea of something besides your bench can't be hit by damage from your opponent's Pokemon. I think you probably wouldn't have to pay as many people too.
This
probably pay one person overtime and you'd be good to go.
Honestly, I don't care if they paid 100 people. This Palkia artwork is pretty insane. The Palkia.
It is sick, but I don't. We don't need a. Do you need a Palkia V star art? Like at some point, I feel like I'm all down. Like I said, I'm all down for alternate arts of cards, but like definitely get rid of golds and rainbow rares, right? I think rainbow rares are done, actually. I think I saw that on
the beach earlier. That, like, 2 minutes
You did? Okay, yeah. Rainbow Rares are done, which is great. Yeah, bring, like, if we're gonna do it, do stuff like this. Don't give us golds and rainbow. They're so ugly too. I think gold cards are staying, but
yeah,
yeah, get rid of the Rainbow Rares for sure. That's insane that it exists. No one likes them. No one likes them anyways. They're like cheaper than, like, I always buy the cheapest cards. I mentioned this before. I have Rainbow Rare Duraludon VMAXs because I was like, I need these. Oh, wait, the Rainbow Rares are cheaper than the regular arts? Okay, I'll buy the cheaper ones. Sure, let's do it.
And then you realize a couple months later, you'll never need them.
Yeah, I'll never need them. I've gotten close a couple times to considering Duraludon. It's almost made it into, like, when I have, like, a top three or four decks to consider playing, it's almost made it in that phase, into that phase of consideration.
And then you're like, I'm glad I've got these Rainbow Rares sitting in the box ready to go.
Hey, man, in a couple years from now, who knows? 10 years from now, Pokemon cards, they always go up, right? So
it's an investment, yeah, for sure.
It's an investment. Yeah, it's an investment for sure. All right, well, I think that covers pretty much. Yeah, so go ahead, take us out, Chip. It's a great episode, but... I think that's all we got to talk about this week.
Yeah, thanks so much to everyone for listening and the support. As always, if you did enjoy, we would really appreciate it if you'd leave us a rating on whichever podcasting platform you are listening on. It does help us out a bunch, and it helps more people find the podcast. Also, if you're watching over on YouTube, be sure to subscribe. Be sure to leave a like on the video. Every single one of our videos gets more views than we have subscribers on the channel. That just makes no
pretty
sense.
Pretty sus.
Right?
Like, that's come pretty on, sus.
You know? Someone out there watching, not clicking the subscribe button. You know, let's make it happen. And yeah, if you guys want to stay connected to us, the best place to do that is over on Twitter. You can follow myself at Chip Ritchie. Azul is at Azul_GG. And you can find the podcast at Uncommon_Energy. Really appreciate the support as always. Thanks for the love. And yeah, thanks so much for listening.
Yep. Catch y'all next week at 7 a.m. Eastern on Tuesdays. Peace.